702.
Weekend Breakfast with Rifin Wim Paganyan.
Live, online,
smartphones,
DSTV channel 856,
92.7 and 106 FM.
It's 9:37 on Weekend Breakfast, the final 23 minutes of the program. And I did say earlier on that we will try and get hold of Wayne Minnar at the JMPD just to find out what in the world is actually happening in town. We've got an alert of taxi drivers fighting around the Carlton Centre area, Commissioner, Corner Troy, that's all blocked off, going to Delvers and Van Veilich Street. We've got a number of pitches as well. No sense of whether or not the JMPD is aware of this or even on the ground. So Wayne Minnar, we have gotten hold of him. He's still investigating. I guess they're going to dispatch their JMPD members and get them on the ground. Let's see if Eyewitness News can pick up on that thread of the conversation. So stay listening to 702 throughout the day for those, hopefully for those updates at the top of every hour. But so far on our side, we've called the relevant authorities and they're investigating. Hopefully they'll get back to us before the show wraps up. But of course, these final moments, so the final half hour of Weekend Breakfast is always spent in the Literature Corner on a Saturday. And today we're having a conversation looking back, of course, to that announcement last week of the Nobel Prize in Literature, considered the pinnacle of achievement for creative writers, has been awarded 114 times to 118 Nobel Prize laureates between 1901 and 2021. This year, that Nobel Prize in Literature went to novelist Abdul Razak Gurnah, who was born in Zanzibar, the first Tanzanian writer to win this prize. And the last black or African writer to win the prize was Wole Soyinka. That was back in 1986. So Gurnah is the first black winner to win since Toni Morrison in 1993. A great achievement by any standards. But I guess a time also to reflect on the importance of these literary awards, the Nobel Prize, and what it means specifically for Abdul Razak Gurnah. To get more, let's get to know the Tanzanian novelist a little bit more, courtesy of or by way of Dr. Shane Lavery, who's a lecturer and research associate at the University of Pretoria. Dr. Shane Lavery, welcome to Weekend Breakfast. Thank you so much for availing yourself for this conversation.
Hi, Rafiwe. Thanks for having me.
An absolute pleasure. I outlined a little bit of the history of the Nobel Prize for Literature and the fact that, you know, it is, of course, the height of creative and literary achievement for so many writers. What, from your vantage point, does the awarding of the Nobel Prize for Literature to Abdul Razak Gurnah, what does it mean? What does it symbolize and effectively mean for the writer himself, the continent at large, I guess?
Yeah, I think the thing about the Nobel Prize that's worth keeping in mind is that the award is awarded for a body of work it's a lifetime body of work, a series of novels that together make a sustained contribution to literature writ large.
Mm-hmm.
So it's not like the Booker or Pulitzer for a single work that stands out as one remarkable achievement.
Yes,
but for this lifetime body of work, and Gurnah's work in particular. You know, it really does convene produces, if you read all of the novels, I've done many times, it produces a particular vision of the world, and you can kind of get lost in the full range of his work. But, I mean, it's incredible. We were just absolutely thrilled, myself and various colleagues and fans last week, was it 2 weeks ago when it was announced?
Last
it was
week,
just,
yeah.
You know, WhatsApp flying wildly, people crying in sheer joy at the announcement, because it just feels like a really under-recognized writer, under-recognized continent being recognized on the world stage.
Yeah, you know, speaking of, you know, under-recognized, and you can just imagine just the jostling of, as you say, a lifetime body of, you know, work being put up for contestation, for, you know, adjudication. It can't be easy, first of all, to be on the other side of that table, but it also, in many ways, is almost an impossible ask. I don't know, is it? if you could describe, you know, to us, you know, that body of work, what Abdulrazak Gurnah's work is either characterized by, exemplified by, what sets it apart? And, you know, as someone, as you said, someone who's read his books and his titles, just talk to us about the writer himself, what he's concerned with.
Yeah. His writing, you know, a lot of writers have essentially one knotty problem that they keep returning to at the heart of their literary art.
Yeah.
And in Gurnah's case, it's, I guess, it, many of the novels chase a similar kind of plotline where a character or a family of characters, several generations, are based in Zanzibar or on the east coast of Africa. Complicated lives, inheritance plots, tricky relational dynamics. It's sort of in the background is often the Tanzanian decolonization and the independence violence that ensued. But that's very much in the background. And then often the character moves to England, or one of the characters moves to England. It feels quite lost. There's a couple of characters who go as refugees or asylum seekers. And then sometimes there's a narrative of return. That's not all of the book. Some are historical fiction that deal with the era of colonization in East Africa in really interesting ways.
Mm-hmm.
But I think the effect of the work overall is to it presents a view of the world that is quite different to what I think you normally see. You normally read a novel and you get this kind of top-heavy, European-centered view of the world where it feels like all the big stories are from the global north, where his is just this very big world that comes across, this very big, very balanced world where stories are centered in East Africa and this kind of ancient Indian Ocean network as much as they are in England and Europe.
Yeah, fascinating stuff. So, of course, it wouldn't be a literature corner if we didn't ask you to pick one or two titles that you would recommend that we read for those of us that are new to Abdulrazak Gurnah, that Tanzanian writer who lives and works in the UK, speaking of, you know, moving abroad and perhaps possibly returning home. But give us a sense of, or give us a sort of rundown of what your first title, I don't know what you want to start with actually, By the Sea perhaps.
yeah,
this is what you recommend.
An earlier one.
Yeah, let's start with By the Sea, what it's about, and of course, what it is that still makes this novel gripping for you and worth revisiting.
Yeah, By the Sea, I think, was one of the first I read of Gurnah's. And it's the first thing to say about it is that it's just got this incredibly elegant prose style. The writing is fluid, compelling. The metaphors are kind of rich and surprising. So, I mean, one thing just to say about his work as a whole is that the prose is beautiful.
Mm-hmm.
It just makes you want to keep reading. This particular book has a wonderful first. It has kind of two narrators who switch names in tricky little ways through the book. But the one narrator, Saleh Omar, is this. He goes as a refugee to or asylum seeker to London, but he refuses to. He can speak English, but he refuses to do so, and he keeps on using the phrase, "I prefer not to." Mm-hmm. So I prefer not to stay in Zanzibar. I prefer not to speak English, and he's making a reference to Melville's Bartleby the Scrivener, Herman Melville's, which is a book that became really popular in the Occupy movement for just, you know, people saying, you know, actually we've had enough, I prefer not to.
Mm.
So it's got this rich literary references, and then it's about this quite sort of Victorian inheritance plot at the heart of it.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. And I guess, you know, you've just touched on those Herman Melville, that reference, and just the references of, I guess, you know, the colonial or colonized territories and countries, and, you know, the writers that spring from there, and the conversation between those texts and, you know, I don't want to call them colonial texts and canons, but, you know, writers from that, from those territories. The conversation, do you think, is often, do you find it can be a two-way conversation, or is it always that referencing back to what we've been taught in school, referencing back to the, you know, the Western text, or, you know, global North text? How do you find that conversation working in contemporary writing and contemporary fiction?
Yeah, I mean, I think often there can be quite a sort of combative, slightly defensive one-way relationship. So, you know, colonial texts represented Africa like this, as the part of darkness, and so the text writes back to that narrative. Mm. So the post-colonial text writes back to that narrative. I find Gerner's text in the main to be more complicated than that.
Sure.
The egalitarian provide a very egalitarian sense of sources. So he's as likely to draw on local myths and narratives of jinns who populate the East African coast, and African writers, as he is to reference Stevenson and Melville and Conrad.
Sure.
And they're often with actually quite a sort of dark humor. So they might be quite sort of sarcastic little references to Conrad or something. But, you know, in a novel like Gerner's Paradise, people have often said is a rewriting of Conrad's Heart of Darkness, but it's as much a rewriting of A Bend in the River.
Mm.
So, you know, it actually takes, you know, the sense of what Africa is was really something that needed, you know, early post-colonial novelists needed to establish. This is what it is. And Gerner much more asks the question, you know, what is it? And,
yeah,
and what are all the varieties of explanations that could be offered?
Yeah, fascinating stuff. And of course, A Bend in the River, that V.S. Naipaul rewriting that you're referencing. And he won a, was he shortlisted? Was Gerner shortlisted for a Booker Prize for Paradise, right?
Yes. Yeah. He was shortlisted.
Back when it came out. All right. So our second book that you're recommending or going to talk to us about this morning is a more recent one, Gravel Heart. Tell us about Gravel Heart and why this has made your list.
Yeah, Gravel Heart is about, it's a more recent book, and it's got a similar sort of plot to By the Sea in some ways. It's a young man who goes, actually much more to Memory of Departure and much earlier work, but a young man goes, you know, it grows up in Zanzibar. His family, he's like kind of, as a child, his family doesn't tell him kind of what's really going on. They're all of these mysterious events. I think like many of us, you kind of aren't really told what is happening as a child.
Mm.
And then he leaves for England to study and feels just immensely lost and uprooted in a way that I think can be familiar to many as well. And then he returns to, so it's one of those novels that doesn't just go from Africa to England, but comes back. And the last third of the novel is this very satisfying recounting in a kind of form of an oral narrative where his father fills in all the gaps in his personal history, which then relate to the wider history of Zanzibar as well.
Mm-hmm. You know, I guess what I always found interesting is reading Pan-African texts from a South African vantage point, because whilst we always bemoan the sort of how insular, you know, countries from the global north can be, or, you know, how they still depict or view African stories, it's always a fantastic reminder of how insular one can be in your own little region of the continent, right? As a South African, reading a Tanzanian novel and getting into the complexities of Tanzanian identity and nationalism and politics as well must be quite compelling and quite interesting. And when you have a writer that can immerse you in all of this, without much struggle or friction. I think you know you're onto a good thing, as it seems Gurna has done.
Yeah, and I mean, I've often prescribed novels by Gurna to South African students, and I am sometimes surprised that they find the material, the context, kind of everything about it as foreign as if I'm prescribing something from France or England. But at the same time, in important ways, eventually, you know, as they get into reading it, you realize that these are just human stories about relationships and memory and how we tell stories about ourselves. And that's how we learn about each other. So it's really about, you know, I find it all a very, it's been very popular in the end. Very foreign at first, very popular in the end.
Yeah, it's really fascinating stuff. And of course, that added benefit of being able to see and understand or get better insights into the African anti-colonial struggle. Once again, mm-hmm. not from our vantage point, further tainted by apartheid, right? Which is its own yeah. thing altogether that so many Africans can't relate to. You know, speaking to a North African friend who's doesn't understand or not understands but can't relate to conversations about race the way, you know, they can be felt so viscerally in a South African context. The power of literature and just reading is really, really incredible.
Yeah. I mean, if I can say one more thing, the most recent book, Afterlife, is he goes back to historical fiction and he writes about the First World War is something we all know, and I'm sure you had the same experience as I did when I first learned about it. I was like, well, that's not the whole world, you know, that's just Europe. And he writes about the First World War from the context of German colonialism in Tanzania,
sure.
which is not something we know enough about, you know, the German recruitment of local forces who then terrorized local populations. So it's this very complicated situation that can't be mapped easily onto black and white, even though those are factors in the history. And again, centers on individuals, each of whom is compelling in their own way and oddly relatable, even though far removed from us in both space and time.
Yeah. Back to the man himself, the work that he's done, and obviously in winning the Nobel Prize for Literature, Abdul Razak Gurna was lauded for, you know, quote, his uncompromising and compassionate penetration of the effects of colonialism and the fates of the refugee and the gulf between cultures and continents, right? And they call him one of the most important contemporary post-colonial novelists writing in Britain today. But he is, as well as, as well as being a fiction writer, he is a distinguished academic and critic as well, and served as a contributing editor, amongst others, for the literary magazine Wasafiri for many years. The role and the importance of literature magazine in just creating fertile ground for more writers of this kind. When you look at where we currently are in the South African context, for instance, who's still around, who's still vibrant when it comes to literary magazines, and just your feelings on this.
Oh, yeah. Wasafiri, actually, I happened to co-edit a special issue of Wasafiri last year that came out in June called Water. And one of my first engagements with scholarship on Gurna was actually my first paper on Gurna, I think, came out in Wasafiri, a local journal. But, the amazing thing, I mean, Wasafiri was just being so thrilled with the award, and Gurna's been an amazing contributor to that magazine. And locally, the Johannesburg Review of Books is a phenomenal institution that promotes local literature, new writers in the most kind of intellectually sound but also popularly relevant way.
Yeah.
I do think that there are opportunities for writers. They often should be a little bit more well financially supported,
of course,
in Africa. But it's still amazing what people are doing.
Yeah. The role of the critic, when done right, when done well, what's the critic's job in literature and in writing from your perspective?
I mean, you know, in the middle of thinking this through myself, I've just finished a book that's coming out, which happens to be have a chapter on Goethe, which just, you know, is a remarkable serendipitous occurrence.
Yes.
and trying to think, you know, Goethe's writing creates this, I guess, empathic, generous, more balanced world that I think can, you know, educate seems to be the wrong word, but sort of give us a different moral sensibility for people that we consider to be strangers and can realize that they're quite similar to ourselves. And I've thought about, you know, what does the critic really add to that, if anything? And one thing is to trace these links, you know, between Goethe's writing and earlier writing from the same region, the references he makes to other histories. So, you know, for instance, Goethe's writing is centered in the Indian Ocean world, which is a place where often forgotten, but where Africa was very involved in the earliest form of globalization, as opposed to just a continent that was the recipient of colonialism and travel and trade. It was actively involved in trade with China and India for hundreds of years. So Goethe's writing is gives that world currency and life. And I think what I certainly hope to do as a critic in my book was to demonstrate the ways in which that it links to real historical events and to a pre-existing literature and oral literature.
Yeah. Thank you so much for your time this morning and your energy and your passion. Please do hit us up when the book is published. and let's see if we can have a conversation around that as well. We really do appreciate your time this morning. That's Dr. Sharnay Lavery, lecturer and research associate at the University of Pretoria.